From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made with an open letter to two young people on the west side of Chicago. The young man and young woman, barely teenagers, are dressed in white shirts and khaki pants, meaning they are public school students. They are kneeling on a corner, being frisked by police. The letter reads, quote, "The cops smiled at one another as they emptied the contents of your book bags into the gutter. Your bags were both white, each with a different word similarly airbrushed in graffiti letters. Your names, I assumed, though I couldn't make them out from where I stood. All I could tell was that one of those names was written in green and the other was in pink. I remember trying to read those letters so that I could yell your names, pretend that I was a friend or a relative, and ask if you were okay. I know how long your encounter lasted because I clocked it. 26 minutes, 43 seconds. I watched the whole time from across the street, transfixed. Later, I told my brother that I watched you so that I could be a witness in the event the incident went awry. But that was only half true. I also watched because I was afraid, and I didn't know what else to do." End quote. The letter was written by Dr. Lawrence Ralph, now a Princeton University professor who moved to the area to attend the University of Chicago. He writes that when he was around the same age as these two young people, he had a similar experience. He and his two brothers had moved to a new town in Maryland and were followed around the mall by a plainclothes officer. That officer took one of the brothers into a room, and he wasn't released until the boy's parents threatened legal action. The man writes that the cop had found no evidence to confirm the officer's suspicion that his brother had done something wrong. In the letter to the young people, who were eventually released, Ralph writes, quote, "We all need to talk, whenever and however we can, about the awful things that we have to deal with as black people in this country, as well as what we can do about them," end quote. That letter is one of the series of letters in Dr. Ralph's new book called The Torture Letters. Dr. Ralph is a social scientist who studies police violence and race. His letters are written to police superintendents, future mayors, victims of police violence, activists, and more. The book, not yet available for purchase, but you can pre-order it, and we've invited Dr. Ralph to join us on the program this hour to talk about his research. He's in town as a guest of the University of Rochester. He'll be speaking tonight at 7 o'clock. We'll tell you about that in a moment, but first, Dr. Ralph, welcome. Nice to have you here on Connections. Thank you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And with us as well, briefly for a hello, is our news director from across the hall. It's Randy Gorman. Hello, Randy.
Hi, Evan. I just want to talk about, of course, the fun drive we have going on this week. When you hear great programs like this on Connections, and there are many of them, and today, of course, very important topic, first hour, police violence and race. We have a candidate, another one of our candidate interviews coming up in the second hour. And to continue that kind of work, we need your support this week. We don't do these drives very often, but this is one of those weeks. So please, if you could, anything you can contribute, or if you want to become a sustaining member, $5, $10 a month, call right now at 454-6300, 454-6300, or you can call at 1-800-295-9994, 1-800-295-9994, or you can just do it online, either use the WXXI app or go to WXXINews.org. Whatever you can contribute, we'll continue great programming here in Rochester on WXXI. Evan.
All right, Randy, thank you very much. Well, tonight, the event is the Lewis Henry Morgan Lecture at the University of Rochester. It's at 7 o'clock in the Lander Auditorium at Hutchinson Hall. It is free and open to the public, and Lawrence Ralph will be there for the event tonight. We're going to get more specific as we go throughout the hour, but when you travel the country to cities like Rochester, what are you hoping audience leave your presentations with?
Well, I hope they leave with a sense of hopefulness about where we can go as a country in terms of addressing the issues of criminal justice and law and order. But I also hope that they learn a lot about how these particular histories of police violence have impacted individual lives. And, you know, we see this on the news all the time, but I think it's important to put individual stories behind the news headlines and the activism that's going on in various communities behind those headlines as well.
Why don't we go through a little bit of your own history as to what experience you had in Chicago and why you focused so much on Chicago. Chicago, of course, is a city that the President of the United States routinely points to as some kind of a breakdown of social order. Take me through a little bit of your own history in Chicago.
Well, I began doing research in Chicago because I started off as a student there. I went to graduate school at the University of Chicago, and originally I didn't think that I would end up, you know, engaged in these research projects there. But while I was there, I was involved in a lot of anti-violence work in the city. And I ended up working a lot with young people who had suffered gunshot injuries and who had been disabled as a result of gun violence. And so I ended up writing my dissertation and my first book on that topic, how people, particularly young people in gangs, kind of reorient their lives after they have suffered a devastating injury, after they are forced to navigate their new world in a wheelchair. And what I didn't get to when I was looking at that problem, specifically the problem of gang violence, was also the related problem, which was police violence, and how these two forms of violence kind of fed off of each other. And so the later part of my research over the past couple of years has been looking at this question of police violence and how that also kind of leads to devastating injuries for particularly communities of color.
I want to ask this question carefully and with sensitivity because I know some of our listeners, this question may be ringing in their ears. They may hear you talk about gang violence and police violence and think, are you equating them? Aren't police just responding to the problem that they might claim that there would be no police violence if there were not? So it's sort of a chicken and egg thing.
Right.
How do you respond to that?
Well, that's a complicated question. What we do know from the research is all over the country is that even when rates of crime, that is to say gang violence, go down in particular communities, that hasn't stopped the upward trajectory of mass incarceration in heavily surveilled communities. And so that's a prime example is Chicago, but it happens all over the country, and where we see that the inclination to punish, the inclination to have more police on the streets, the inclination to lock more people up, and the inclination to kill more people hasn't responded to the crime problem in any systemic way. And so what I want to do is to look at kind of both sides of the coin and say, you know, people and communities all over the country are invested in trying to make their communities more safe. And it's not an either-or situation. It's a both-and situation. People are heavily invested in trying to reduce crime. And this includes people involved in churches, people involved in nonviolence organizations like I was. But it also includes trying to stop the kind of heavily surveillance that plagues certain communities and the police violence and oftentimes police killing that ends up as a result of that.
And this is where I think of the recent work, and we're going to have the author Ibram X. Kendi on the program in the next couple of weeks, talking about his work about racism and his view of the way we think about racism, taking sort of the emotion or even the intention out of it. Because when you talk to police chiefs or police officers, you know, they'll often say things like, well, I don't have a racist bone in my body, or, you know, I want what's best for everybody. And Kendi is saying that we need to remove intentionality and just boil our actions down to either racist or anti-racist. And it's essentially a zero-sum game. You are either engaging in actions and words that are racist in nature or anti-racist in nature, and removing some of that emotion, and that might be a more effective framework to look at things. Do you agree with that?
I do agree with that, and I think that's a great way of putting it. I think that you referred earlier to like the chicken and the egg situation. Mm-hmm. I think we often get caught in that cycle. And, you know, there was a time in the 80s and early 90s in which you know, a lot of when I talk to police officers and politicians, they make the argument that communities of color wanted more police, you know, and, you know, no one could have foreseen the kind of the level of incarceration that would come in the several decades after the 90s. And no one could have imagined that mass incarceration in the U.S. would be what it was today. But we do have to, you know, again, take the intention out of it and say, what can we do about it now? You know, now that we know that this is a system that will not lead to more justice and will not necessarily keep our streets more safe.
Well, and so when you talk about wanting audiences to leave with some kind of hope, I think about the conversation we had, I think, in 2015. It was probably about a year after Ferguson. And the contrast to what you just said, communities of color decades ago asking for more police and more police presence, perhaps not foreseeing what could end up being the result, mass incarceration, unequal rates of arrest and prosecution. And so in 2015, we had a conversation with a panel of some African-American activists, and I don't want to speak as if this is monolithically. There's difference of opinion within movements, et cetera. But these particular activists were calling for the entire abolition of police, saying that they have entirely lost confidence, that they don't feel that there is a path forward in this country with policing at all, that there has to be an entirely new model of community protection. Now, many of our listeners were saying, how could you say that? But in my view, even if I didn't find myself personally agreeing, I thought that is a logical end result for some non-zero number of people who've been so sort of psychically injured from decades of interactions like this. What do you make of those kinds of calls? And do you have any sort of sympathy or agreement with this idea that we will not be able to create a society that can be policed in a way that feels safe and equitable and fair?
Well, I will say that I do hear that all the time doing research, especially in Chicago. The way that, you know, there's a growing number of scholars as well, myself included, who are thinking through the question of abolition. And in an intellectual sense, it's not just about eradicating the police. It's also about imagining a society in which we don't rely on the police to do everything that they're doing now. And so in order to get to a space where we can imagine that, we have to kind of think beyond it. And that is the space of abolition. And I think in concrete ways, what it boils down to is this. And like oftentimes in cities all over the country, the police are relied upon to be social workers. They're relied upon to be janitors. They're relied on to be mental health experts, and they're relied upon to solve crimes. When people see something going wrong, they feel like they have no other recourse but to call the police, right? We just saw this in Fort Worth with the woman who was killed in her home by a police officer. Her neighbor, seeing the door open, called a hotline that was supposed to be a nonviolent hotline for someone to come and check, do a welfare check on his neighbor, and the police arrived and ended up shooting his neighbor and killing her. And so so the question becomes, who else do we call in such a situation? Who do we rely on that is equipped not to react with violence first? And I think we have to be able to imagine a society in which that is possible.
My guest this hour, Lawrence Ralph, is a professor of anthropology and director of the Center on Transitional Policing at Princeton University, author of Renegade Dreams, Living Through Injury in Gangland, Chicago, and the forthcoming The Torture Letters, and giving a presentation tonight at the University of Rochester at 7 o'clock. It's in the Lander Auditorium at Hutchinson Hall. It is free and open to the public. The title of the presentation, Black Cargo, An Ethnographic Exploration of Linked Fate. And in The Torture Letters, you know, you're a social scientist, but you chose this epistolary form, and we read some of that in our introduction. Letters that you wrote to youth of color, to people in policing, future mayors. I mean, why did you choose this form? I'm very curious about that.
Yeah, I chose it because oftentimes as social scientists, we are definitely trained to take a distance approach in which we can presumably like hover above the issue and not take a side. And I think that when we deal with particular issues, it necessitates that we speak from where we understand the problem to be. What I mean is that in writing the torture letters, I was writing about a scandal in the history of Chicago in which 125 black men were tortured while in police custody, right? And if I feel as a social scientist, I can't say that that is wrong. I think that there's a problem. And so I think that there are instances where, as a scholar, we do need to take a stand. That was one reason. The other reason was when I was talking to Chicago residents, they had various ideas about who I should write to and what this book should be. And I wanted to take that seriously. I didn't want the book just to be relevant to other academics interested in police violence. I wanted it to be relevant to the audiences, the people in Chicago who I was talking to and talking with felt was important. And it just, the list just grew and grew and grew. And I felt that letters was an appropriate way to address those multiple constituencies.
So take future mayors. What do you want future mayors to know?
Well, I want them to know that, they can't just start with the problem at hand and act as if they have a clean slate. These problems come with histories, often, generational trauma that their residents are living with. And so when we think about any step moving forward, we also have to take those kind of histories into account. And we also have to think about what we're investing in and how what we're investing in, both morally, politically, and economically, how those investments reflect our values.
Police superintendents themselves and the officers, what would a letter to them sound like?
Well, when I talked to police officers and I looked at the history of the scandal of police torture in particular, it's just striking how much various officers knew to a certain extent what was going on. You know, they might have not known the whole story, but I felt that why they didn't know was really important. You know, why they didn't know was that some officers didn't want to know. They actively, made it a point not to get any more information. You know, if they heard strange noises coming from an interrogation room, they didn't go in. You know, they avoided officers who they thought were bad apples, right? And what I want them to know is that, you know, this so-called code of silence, this blue wall of silence, it's not helping anybody. And so we have to be courageous enough as police officers and as kind of members of any organization to expose these open secrets when we know about them.
Now, we're working on Chicago here. We're looking at Chicago, but our listeners here in Rochester may wonder if your view of police action, torture, the history of these kind of actions, if it's really specific to Chicago or if it really does travel. I mean, if this narrative is not just a narrative but a fact of history in this country, in most major urban centers. Is that how you view it?
I do view it that way in this sense, right? When I go to other cities, when I talk to other police departments, the question I ask is not necessarily, has this happened here? It's, what is to prevent it from happening here? And that question is a question that, you know, people don't have the answer to. And so I think it happened in Chicago because there is an incentive structure to rise up the ranks as a police officer, to close cases, to reward people who are able to get confessions in a way that those people become shielded and protected. And, you know, they can even create their own kind of team of people to agree to break the law, right? And hide behind the badge when they do that, right? And I see that same incentive structure all over the country. And I see it and other police departments. And so what we're doing is we're relying on the good faith of the great police officers who are out there to not do it. But we're not putting structural blockade so that it can't happen. And that's what I'm calling for in this book.
Well, in this community, there's a referendum on the ballot less than 2 weeks from now, on Election Day, 13 days from now, that would determine whether a change and a broadening of the ability of a police accountability board can go forward here. Now, that could get hung up in the courts, and there's going to be a debate. In fact, next Wednesday, a week from today, listeners, we're going to have the head of the police union in Rochester on this program, along with some of the wide coalition of members in our community who have been pushing for this police accountability board, and they're going to have a conversation about it. The advocates have said that if you ultimately have police accountability hearings and investigations which can be nullified by the police chief, then you don't really have accountability. That if whatever board is doing the reviewing can only offer recommendations, and the chief can decide, yes, we're going to discipline this way, or no, we're not, we see it a different way, then there's no teeth. And that in this community, we're having that debate. How important are those kinds of mechanisms, police accountability boards? What have you seen there?
Well, I'm studying a case in New Orleans right now where this question is an issue. And I think that, you know, in terms of police accountability boards, we do have to take the question of accountability seriously. And I think that means community, not only community input, but the community's ability to affect what ultimately happens in those cases as well. You know, I think that what we know from the research is that there are problems when we leave the final decisions up to the police ultimately. And these problems can come along with, you know, repercussions for those who have stepped forward in the community against police officers. And it can be a frightening thing, and it erodes the legitimacy and trust ultimately. So I think in order to avoid that, you know, the community aspect of it has to have real merit at teeth, as you say.
And I, you know, I know it's hard to ask you to, I don't want to ask you to wade in specifically because you're not a resident of Rochester, you haven't maybe
right.
studied it. But generally speaking, what we hear from police is that that officers want to do right by the law and right by the citizenry. Their concern is if a police accountability board gains this power, that officers, quote unquote, on the street will feel second guessing of themselves in a moment because they don't want to be perceived as too violent or too rough or too strong in their response in a situation, thereby potentially endangering themselves. Does that argument carry any weight with you?
It does carry weight, but I think part of the problem with the police's use of force all over the country is this question of discretion. And I think the police officer's discretion and that impulse to enact violence, what that does in the moment. And I think that we can't address any of these problems as if they're isolated, a problem onto itself, right? The question of accountability is also tied to the question of training, which is also tied to the question of recruitment. And so there does need to be an overhaul in the way that we are trained to think about discretion and the way that we're trained to think about impulses and the way that we're trained to think about threat, who is a threat and what constitutes a threat and all of that. But, you know, in a vast majority of these instances of police force, the police officer did need to second guess, right? And I think that... we have to think about that holistically. What does it mean to use discretion? What does it mean to de-escalate? What does it mean to act on one's impulse in the moment? And we have to think about the question of training in relation to accountability as well.
Yeah, and the high-profile cases now, of which there are many names well beyond Michael Brown in this country that many Americans would know. I'm routinely surprised when I talk to law enforcement officers about the Philando Castile case and to hear sometimes equivocation. The previous Monroe County sheriff who did not win re-election told us on this program that he wasn't really sure if that was a case of police responding with too much force. And for listeners who forget, Philando Castile was someone who had a firearm on him during a routine police stop, was a passenger in a car, wanted to let the officer know he was permitted to have it, and just wanted to do the diligence of letting the officer know, hey, I've got this. And the officer essentially lost it and fired 7 shots and killed him for really no reason. And I thought that was the obvious case. I thought if we can't clearly say that this is a case of what happens when we've kind of lost our collective minds with either implicit bias or fear, is that a case that stands out to you in that way?
Definitely. It definitely stands out to me in that way, and it stands out in another reason. You would think that in such a case, like the NRA would take that on as well, because this is a person who has a legal right to carry a firearm, and he's informing the police officer of that legal right. But there you see that the implicit bias is not just about the police officer. It's also about, the threat of an African-American male with a gun, right? And so I think that there are deep-seated, histories of racism involved as well that affect the ability to perceive it for what it is,
And speaking of Michael Brown, I did want to get your take on some of the writing of Nicholas Kristof, who's a longtime New York Times columnist and an author himself. After the Department of Justice and Eric Holder's report on Ferguson came out, Kristof wrote the following, and he received a lot of backlash for this. Here's what he wrote about Michael Brown. He wrote, quote, "Activists perhaps should have focused less on Michael Brown, more on the shooting of 12-year-old Tamir Rice in Cleveland," end quote. And he said that in response to the report from Attorney General Holder and after reading this summary posted on Vox.com of that DOJ report. Quote, "An investigation from the Justice Department laid out a strong case in Ferguson in Officer Wilson's favor. The physical evidence suggested Brown reached into Wilson's car during their physical altercation and, very likely, attempted to grab the officer's gun. The most credible witnesses agreed that Brown moved toward Wilson before the officer fired his final shots, and there simply wasn't enough evidence, especially given the struggle at the car, that Officer Wilson wasn't justified in fearing for his life when he fired the shots that killed Michael Brown," end quote. So Nick Kristof is saying, hey, we need a movement, but the Ferguson case was the wrong case for those reasons. And he received a lot of backlash, a lot of heat for that. What do you make of his comments there?
Well, I think the reason why he received a lot of heat is because I think oftentimes when we think about these movements, we think about them within a kind of legal framework almost, as if like we're looking for the right case to try in court, right? But people aren't necessarily who are most impacted by police violence or any issue, like take the Me Too, for example. They know these things happen, right? And so this is confirming what they already know. So they don't need the person being victimized to be the ultimate pristine person to hold up, right? And I think that there's a rejection of that now, and there's a recognition that that is problematic. That's one of the things that I write about in the torture letters, because of the 125 people who were tortured, some of them, maybe most of them, I don't know, were guilty of the crimes that they were accused of. But what does it mean when a police officer tortures them anyway, right? I think that we have due process for a reason. We have, the ability for someone to have a right to a speedy trial for a reason. We can't just bypass all of that and leave it up to a police officer to make the decision in the moment. And so part of what I'm saying is, even if someone is guilty of a crime, does that mean that they have a right to be tortured, right?
Our guest this hour is speaking at the University of Rochester, and a great chance to hear Lawrence Ralph tonight, 7 o'clock at the Lander Auditorium at the University of Rochester. That event is free and open to the public, titled Black Cargo, an ethnographic exploration of linked fate. Dr. Ralph's new book, The Torture Letters, is coming out when, by the way? When can people get it?
It's going to be out in January.
In January.
Yeah.
I always like to ask authors because, you know, people want to support your work and still purchase books. We still read books now.
Yeah, that's great news.
He has some previous work as well. In fact, his first book, Renegade Dreams, Living Through Injury in Gangland, Chicago, is certainly available. The Torture Letters, forthcoming in January. He's a professor of anthropology and director of the Center on Transitional Policing at Princeton University. And if you want to join the program, you can call the program toll-free. It's 844-295-TALK. It's called 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections@WXXI.org. Coming up in our second hour, we sit down with Adam Bello, the Democrat running for Monroe County Executive. Our goal was to bring together the candidates on the same program. Adam Bello, the Democrat, Cheryl Donolfo, the incumbent Republican. But the county executive has declined our request for interviews in advance of the election. So we have an interview with the Democrat, Adam Bello, in studio, answering our questions and yours next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. A brief correction. I want to make sure we correct the record here because Dr. Ralph is too kind to do it, but I'll do it. He's a professor of anthropology and the director of the Center on Transnational Policing at Princeton University, though transitional policing sounds like it would make sense too. Transnational policing is the work that he's doing at Princeton University. And Randy Gorbin, our news director at WXXI, is back in here for a brief moment. Hello, Randy.
Hi, Evan. Another very important, very interesting hour of Connections, something that comes to you with the help of donations from people who are listening. And this is how we get most of our budget. That is by folks who are contributing to what they like to hear, what they expect to hear every day from WXXI. I want to mention that whatever you can contribute during our pledge drive this hour is being matched dollar for dollar by one of our members of the Board of Trustees at WXXI, David Tang, relatively recent member, very enthusiastic about being on the board, has some great ideas. So we hope you will take advantage of his generosity and make a donation now to 454-6300. 454-6300. Out of the area, you can call 1-800-295-9994, 1-800-295-9994, or you can use the WXXI app on your smartphone or go to WXXINews.org. Whatever you can contribute will go to continuing great programming like what you hear right here on Connections. Evan?
All right. Thank you very much, Randy Gorbman. We're going to get a little bit of listener feedback now for Dr. Ralph, so let's go ahead and take our first call. It's John in Rochester. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. Hey, Professor. Professor, I'd like you to clarify a couple things that you talked about, mass incarceration. I think a lot of people are in favor of mass incarceration of violent felons, and I think that's a good thing. The other thing I want you to address is you made the statement about eradicating the police. That sounds awfully tough and unfair, eradicating the police. Could you clarify those two points? And also Michael Brown. Michael Brown, in my opinion, and a lot of opinions, was guilty as sin and was a thug. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so when we think about the question of mass incarceration, it is precisely about both violent, what we call violent crime and nonviolent crime. And the reason why it has risen to the level of the U.S. being the highest incarcerator in world history is mostly because of nonviolent offenses, such as drug offenses. And so we wouldn't have mass incarceration as we know it today without those nonviolent offenses. The second thing about the notion of abolition, well, I was saying that I think when people say abolition, what the public often hears is eradicating the police. And what I was saying that is not just about eradicating the police. It's about imagining a society where the police aren't tasked with doing everything in order to maintain social order. How can we think about different groups or different professionals responding to crises in different ways. Like when we have someone having a mental health crisis, how can we think about getting someone who is trained to address that issue there instead of the police, right? And so that's part of what we need to think about when we think about making our community safer. And the question of Michael Brown, what I was saying is I think that when we, it's not just a question of who is guilty of a certain crime and who is not when we think about police homicides, right? The reason why we have so many police homicides is because we're leaving it up to police officers to make that decision for themselves in the moment. But that's actually what the criminal justice system is for. That's why we have courts, and that's why we have all of this whole infrastructure to adjudicate whether someone is guilty or innocent. And so I think when we look at someone and see them as a threat, that leads to the violence that we're dealing with today, rather than giving everyone the chance to go through due process and having a jury of their peers make that decision.
Well, Christoph from the New York Times, I think he had a good take on the Michael Brown situation. That's the wrong martyr that you want to put up against police brutality. I agree with Christoph. Do you agree with Christoph?
I don't think we should be putting up any martyrs to deal with police brutality. I think we should look at it as an ethical issue about whether or not we're leaving it up to police to be the judge, jury, and executioner in a given moment.
Do you take issue with John's use of the word thug in that case?
Yeah, I mean, I think we don't know. You know, I mean, I think we don't know. You know, the truth is we don't know what's happening in that moment, right? And so I think the name calling is missing the point. I mean, the point is, like, how can we make it safer? And if it was just an incident of somebody's life being in danger, we wouldn't see this pattern all across the U.S. And I think that it's risen to the level of a social issue in the United States of America precisely because it happens so frequently. And one way historically we've discredited victims is by calling them names like thugs and saying that they weren't angels. And I think that we need to move away from that if we want to address the problem.
Can I go back to the way we opened the program, talking about the letter to two young people on the west side of Chicago, the young man and the young woman. Can you tell me more about what you saw there and how you think it relates to, you know, the experiences of young people of color in this country?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, part of what I'm asking for is a more empathetic eye towards those who are living, with the police violence or the prospect of police violence. And I think that, if you're living in these communities or you're engaging with people in these communities, it's a common thing to see people pulled over on the street, harassed, and brutalized. And we need to be able to think about what that experience does to them, like what that erosion of trust does for them. And I think we can all agree that that's not good. And so what I'm trying to do is to sit within that space where people are being victimized. It might not escalate to a death. It might not escalate to a profound act of violence, but it does rise to the level of an erosion of trust and an inability to feel safe in one's own community. And I think that's important to address.
Well, I think this is where it's important for me as a white reader of your work and someone who's trying to understand our society better to kind of ask myself, what's instructive about this kind of moment? Because if I see police interviewing people, talking to people, even arresting someone, I generally, that's not my business. I move on. All right. I mean, it doesn't really impact me. And that's an advantage I have in society of not feeling impacted. That's when you saw what was happening, you felt compelled for multiple reasons, as you say, to stay. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was this recognition that not only that this was happening, and, you know, in the moment, I don't know what's happening.
And can you set the scene again for our listeners who missed it earlier?
Yeah. Right. So, you know, this is when I was a grad student at the University of Chicago, and I'm walking down a street in an African-American neighborhood, and I see two very young kids getting basically frisked on their way to school, right? And so in that moment, something just compelled me to stop and watch and to see what's going on and see what's happening. And part of me knew that I was watching because I knew it could escalate to violence. And this is a moment, I think, you know, where people have begun, you know, recording the police and in case something happens, right? And so I'm just watching, and later when I'm reflecting on this moment, I realize that part of the reason why I'm watching is because something similar happened to me when I was around that age, you know? And I think that when I was around that age, I had all these questions about, you know, did I do something wrong? Did the people who I were my two older brothers, did we do something wrong? What were we wearing? Did we put our hands in our pocket? Did we walk too fast through the mall? And then, you know, for so many years, I kind of, you know, suppressed that, you know, and had feelings of guilt around that before realizing that this happens every day, all the time, to people of color all throughout the country. And if we never talk about the way it happens and the extent to which it happens, we can't, you know, develop a way to hold police accountable, but also to have police not look at us as threats and say that it's okay to wear what we're wearing. It's okay to be who we are, and that doesn't mean that we deserve to be harassed.
Do you think today, if you noticed a similar situation where officers were arresting or interviewing young African Americans on the street, would you find yourself nervous about what the outcome was likely to be? Would you stop and watch it?
Yeah, I definitely would. I think that's something that hasn't left. I mean, I think what I'm writing about and thinking through now is exactly when and where those kind of feelings of solidarity develop for people who have been victimized by police violence, but also for Black people in general. Like these names, Altrin Sterling, Michael Brown, Botham Jean, Sandra Bland.
Walter Scott.
I mean, these aren't just names. They orient us and make us think about what could potentially happen to us and our loved ones. And so one knows at any given moment either your name or the name of someone you love can be added to that list. So I think that there is a concern there, and there's a need to kind of think about that, you know, every day, you know.
Adam writes to the program and wants to know if you're seeing any police departments in the country do it better through training or anything else.
I think a lot of police departments now are working on the question of reform and the question of training. And I think, you know, there's not a magic bullet that has been developed that could solve the problem. But I think key to the problem is something that we talked about earlier, and I think that's community involvement and really grappling with these histories in a real way and not just saying that, okay, this has happened, but it's a new day now. There's a new police chief, there's a new mayor, but really grappling with the history and why it's happening and moving forward with a kind of shared sense of the community has stakes in what's happening now. And I think that's really important.
If the Rochester Police Department called to ask you to come in and just advise us a little bit, talk to us, tell us what's a first step? Where do we start if we want to make this change?
I think any start, you know, for a city at the city level starts with grappling with that city's unique history, right? And being honest about that unique history and how it affects policing practices today. Not only like what the police do, but also, you know, who wants to be a police officer and has that changed? And, you know, why, you know, do people, why are people drawn to this profession or not anymore? Because I think all of that, you know, gives us good information about where we're going moving forward. I think that at the end of the day, we all believe that we want safer communities, but how do people create safe spaces for themselves now is a critical question along those lines.
And when you talk about who wants to be police officers, there's a lot of talk about representation for obvious reasons. The city of Rochester now has an African-American police chief, and we've seen efforts at recruitment and representation to try to move some of those numbers. I mean, I don't know that there is a department in the country that's fully reflective of its local population. And just as we don't really have school districts that have equal representation for teachers of color as there are right. for students of color, it's an issue. But is that representation, is it overstated? Is it massively important as we talk about it so much? And does the installation of, for example, an African-American chief, is that a big stride for communities?
I mean, not necessarily. As with anything with representational politics, it's not necessarily the case that, you know, just because you have one person in there, it can make a huge difference. But I do think the question of who wants to be a police officer and why is vitally important. When I'm talking to youth of color who are victimized by the police, what they often say to me is that I wanted to be a police officer before this happened. I actually, you know, liked the police, or my uncle was a police officer, or my father was a police officer, but now I can't do it. Or sometimes even those people in their family who were police officers told them not to because of what they feel the police are made to do. And so I think that that's telling, you know, and I think that we have to think about what police officers feel like they're made to do, what communities they feel like they're targeting in the act of policing. I think all those are relevant questions.
I close with a question that always has a danger of being trite, but I ask it for a reason, and I want to be clear. I'm not asking it in the hopes that you will say yes, or in the hopes that you will sort of assuage any sort of white anxiety. I just want to ask directly, do you feel hopeful that this country will have the kind of policing that you'd like to see within your lifetime?
Wow, that's a good question. I feel hopeful. I have to feel hopeful. You know, I mean, I think that it's easy to say that one doesn't feel hopeful when we look at just the reality of the situation and the momentous challenge before us. But I wouldn't be a professor if I didn't have hope, and I wouldn't write, you know, these books if I didn't have hope, and I wouldn't talk to, you know, police departments across the country and people who have been victimized by the police if I didn't have hope. So I think I have to have hope, and you know, that's what propels me forward. So, you know, I realize the gravity of the situation, but we still have to maintain.
Dr. Lawrence Ralph is a professor of anthropology, director of the Center on Transnational Policing at Princeton University. His forthcoming book is called The Torture Letters. It's out in January. You can pre-order now. And he is in Rochester as a guest of the University of Rochester tonight, 7 o'clock, in the Lander Auditorium at Hutchinson Hall at the U of R. It is free. and open to the public. And thanks to the entire team there. They've got a great team. Professor Mariner, among many others there, putting this event together, and they'd love to see you tonight. Dr. Ralph, thank you. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Short break. More Connections and Adam Bello coming up next.